With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, PodcastOne.com, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Quick break to tell you guys about NFL Game Pass, the only way that you can replay every game all season long. You can relive all the gutsy calls, crazy catches, wild comebacks, and breakout stars from every game every week. It's all the action, all the football you can handle, all in one place. So every game that we're talking about right now, you guys can rewatch it after the fact. I'm going to be going back, and you guys can too. Go check out Lamar Jackson in week one. Go check out Dak Prescott and what that Cowboys offense actually did. Go check out Kyler Murray and his NFL debut. That's my favorite thing about NFL Game Pass. You can go back and watch at any time. And if you haven't watched a condensed game yet, you have to try it out. It's every play from the game back to back to back, so you can replay an entire NFL game in the fraction of the time it normally takes. It's how I'm able to follow all the MVP candidates, all the breakout stars, and, of course, your waiver wire pickups all season long. To see all the action this season and stay on top of all the big storylines, you need NFL Game Pass. Best of all, you can kick off the 2019 NFL season with a 7-day free trial of NFL Game Pass. Just sign up now at NFL.com/ProFootballFocusNFL.
Podcast One presents. This is a collect call from Sing Sing.
My name is John J. Lennon. I'm locked up for selling drugs and committing murder. I'm also a contributor for Esquire magazine and the Marshall Project. So I'm a writer and I'm a prisoner. Imagine trying to stay focused and talk about issues of substance with geeks slamming, prisoners screaming, and PAs blaring in the background.
Get new episodes every Wednesday on Spotify, Podcast One, and Apple Podcasts.
I mean, what's Pro Football Focus doing? Last week they had Brady. This week they got Brady.
We're doing it. We're literally doing it differently from everybody else.
As a matter of fact, moving forward from this point on, I will not make reference to PFL.
Do you not understand that they are that way because you're Joe Flacco?
You just like to discredit things that people deserve credit for.
That you can't possibly be expected to defend that.
Talk about the game, fam. So, who cares about what people think about us?
Yeah, I like football. I like football season, all the things that go with it.
Welcome into the PFF NFL Podcast. Steve Palazzolo back here with Sam Monson. Sam, how many words have you written this week?
Like 12,000, something like that.
That's it? All on this one PFF, all decade 101. Did you know that was my idea this offseason? All that work you did was my idea?
Huh.
Yeah.
You get credit for that, or is that all me?
No. I'm letting you take credit for it.
Okay.
So, and that's what we're going to discuss today. It is a perfect time here in the middle of May to look back at the previous decade, 2010 through 2019, and not only did we put out an all-decade team a few weeks back, we have the best 101 players of the entire decade. So let's discuss it and what went into it. And it's pretty cool, man, the fact that PFF's been around long enough that we could actually have an all-decade team with grades on all these guys.
Right, that part is cool. It's also kind of cool going through, just diving back into history a little bit that far, you know, so looking at some of these players and remembering how good they were and all this kind of thing. One of the things that's tricky is obviously any all-decade series, whether it's a 101, whether it's the all-decade team, ours or the NFL's, you put yourself into a bind, right? Because there are some players whose careers fit beautifully into a decade. They come along, you know, basically at the turn of the decade. They end basically at the end of the decade, and their entire career spans neatly into that box. There's other guys who their career could not be timed worse for a decade, right? They come along and like, whatever, five. They last 5 years of one decade, 5 years of another decade, and they evenly split two completely different decades, and they get kind of screwed with these teams. And that's been right. The case for years when the NFL did these teams, and it's the case now for us. there are some players here who, you know, they're amongst the best players we've ever seen, but they don't rank high on an all-decade list because we only saw, you know, a few years of their career at the tail end or the start or whatever it is. You know, we just didn't see the entirety of their careers, so they're not as high on the list as you might expect.
Yeah, you and I went through, so we finalized this list. And again, the PFF grade is the guiding light for a lot of these things, but we did have to sit there and debate. Like, the only thing keeping Aaron Donald from number one is probably the fact that he was in college at the top of the decade, right? I mean, if we had a full 10 seasons of him, or, you know, there's a bunch of guys in the 5,000 or 6,000 snap range. There's guys like George Kittle who only have like 3 years under their belt who didn't make the cut. So we set like a snap cutoff of 4,000 to 5,000, depending on the position. Every position's a little different. And then we did have to balance, you know, longevity. You know, there are guys who had over 10,000 snaps of awesome, and there are guys who had 5,000 snaps of really awesome. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that all went into this discussion. It's all over at PFF.com. You can check it out. Sam did a great job of writing it all up outside of the four guys that I wrote up, Sam. Or five.
You got it. Yeah, you got a fifth one in there.
I need like 5% of the credit that you get for this thing. So where do you want to start here? You mentioned the process. I think it was really cool, right? We're putting this together and you're thinking back to how good were these guys at the beginning of the decade? How about the guys that are still going right now? There's some guys who only do have the 4 or 5 years of sample sizes, but you know, their next 5 years are going to be, you know, maybe they'd be top 20 guys if they had a little bit more. What do you think of this entire process of putting it together?
Yeah, well, I think the biggest thing was that tension that we just talked about between longevity and peak. And that kind of it's topical as well, because today's Frank Gore's birthday and everybody's getting up in arms about whether Frank Gore is a Hall of Famer, you know, because he's what, third all time in terms of rushing lists, but at any point in his career was probably not great. I mean, I tweeted something like he's testing the question of how long do you need to be good for before being good for that length of time just automatically transforms you into being great. Right, you can be good. How many years do you need to be good before all those years of being good changes you somehow into being great, even though you were never actually great in the first place? That's basically what Frank Gore's testing.
So that's a good question, though, because even with our grades, and I use this example a lot, people ask us a lot about the grades and how do the game grades translate to season grades. So if you've heard this before, you know, I'm sorry, but we have a whole bunch of new listeners, right? When we go from a game grade to a season grade, a lot of times a guy will have a bunch of good games. And if you add that up 16 times, it becomes a really good season grade. And the example I always use is like from if you were using stats, a 300 yard passing game by a quarterback isn't great. Or say a 3-touchdown game by a quarterback, you know, in the grand scheme of things, we see this all the time. Quarterbacks throw 3 touchdowns all the time. Probably 6 or 7 guys do that every single week in the NFL. It's not close to the best game we've ever seen, just from a touchdown perspective. But if you do it 16 times, that's 48, and you're Dan Marino in 1984. So there is this, you know, do you ever put anything great together? Maybe not, but if you put a whole bunch of good together, when you add it all up, it's like, okay, that is pretty good. I think in our world with these snap totals, the guys that had volume of sustained good to very good were guys like Devin McCourty, guys like Andrew Whitworth, Eric Weddle, Alex Mack, Phillip Rivers. I mean, these are guys who maybe not at their pinnacles were like top 10 players or, you know, multiple years of top 3 at their various positions, but it's just been like solid from start to finish throughout this decade. All those guys have over 10,000 snaps this decade.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely logic to it. It's just that it gets you into a very awkward territory, because if you're willing to accept that longevity of doing something makes the thing you're doing better, then you get into this territory of, well, how average can you be to start with and become transformed into something great just by playing for an extremely long time? Like, how much longer would Vinny Testaverde have needed to play before he was one of the all-time greatest quarterbacks in NFL history? You know what I mean? Like,
a lot longer.
Right, for his entire career, he was basically an exercise. He was like Jameis Winston before Jameis, like just too many mistakes, too many bad things, but he was durable and he lasted a long time. And way back in the day, he was seen as the next great franchise quarterback. So he kept getting jobs and kept getting jobs and kept getting jobs. And he retired top seven in all the major passing categories, right? But at no point did anybody even remotely consider him for the Hall of Fame, because that would have been absurd. But by this logic,
the best comp you ever made.
Right. But by this logic, after enough years, suddenly Vinny Testaverde is a Hall of Famer because he's been transformed into something he never was. That's the sort of precedent you open up by that line of logic. And it's just, as opposed to, you know, the other end of the scale is the Terrell Davis or the Kurt Warners, right? Where it's really short, but the peak is undeniable. I just think that's a cleaner, thing to be leaning on, because nobody disputes how great they were. Now,
yeah,
if you
Kurt
want to take
Warner
that,
and Terrell Owens were probably top three at their position Davis. For half their career.
Yeah.
We're on delay here. Yeah, it is. It's an interesting debate. It's a tough one. The Vinny Testaverde comp, that I don't know if you came up with it, but people were comparing them at the end of last season when Jameis was going for that 30-30 club. That was perfect, though. Vinny had his breakout in like year 12. The only difference is Vinny kept getting jobs, like you said, and Jameis, well, still out there.
Yes, I mean, that is, I guess, I don't know if the NFL's learned lessons since the Vinny thing, but I mean, Testaverde is just like, if the reason you're giving is because of a number that they've reached in all-time compiling statistics, that causes problems, because that opens the doors to guys like that. And that's, nobody wants that. I think even the people that are arguing for that don't want those guys. And that's what you open up when you start to lean in that direction.
All right. You want to go reverse order through the list? Some, you know, highlight some of our favorite names or pain points and various things like that.
Sure.
All right. So let's start at the bottom 20 or so of the list. There were definitely some guys. Did you come across? I think we both kind of came across guys that maybe we were surprised to see the grade be that good for a guy. Guys like Emmanuel Sanders, who were on there for me. I kept looking at and was like, "Huh, he has been very good for the majority of his career." But I was surprised to see him that high from a grading standpoint. And we had the exact debate. We debated him and like Odell Beckham. Odell Beckham's peak, while very small so far, has been outstanding. You know, yeah. We did have a bunch of receivers in that bottom 20.
Yeah, the bottom 20 was like, it was receiver town. That was where we ended up with it. There was a ton of receivers made this list overall, and the bottom 20 is where they all seem to live, whether it was the guys you mentioned, whether it was Keenan Allen. There was just Doug Baldwin, Dez Bryant. There's a ton of those guys lasted that long. One guy, I think, where it's jumping a little bit higher, but Jordy Nelson was one of those sort of players that when you're doing this, it's like we kind of remember the tail end of his career, what was falling over. But the Jordy Nelson to Aaron Rodgers connection, you know, for the first half of this decade was pretty spectacular. Like Jordy Nelson for his entire career yielded a passer rating of like 118 or something insane when he was targeted. Like that, those numbers are just absurd. And I mean, for a long period of time, like he was the beneficiary of the great Aaron Rodgers when he was at his very best. And that, like, I think we sort of, again, it's just time and recency bias skews you, but Jordy Nelson for a really long time was a phenomenal receiver.
Yeah, he really was. His peak was outstanding. I thought one of the, again, in this bottom 20 here, you have guys like David Bakhtiari, who started in 2013, offensive tackle. By the way, we never really prefaced this. All positions created equally here. Snap count matters, usage matters, and all that stuff. But we're not just stacking all the quarterbacks. It's not all positional value. So we tried to give everybody a fair shot. But with Bakhtiari, right now, I think he's established himself as the best pass-blocking tackle in the NFL. But he started out as good, right? And he got better as a run blocker. He didn't immediately step in as an elite pass blocking tackle like Joe Thomas did, but he eventually got to that level. So that put him at 84. And then you have a guy like Aqib Talib, who started slow, but his peaks from probably 2012 through 16 or so, he had the no fly zone with Denver. He had a couple years in New England. Like when New England transition. They transitioned from a zone heavy scheme to man heavy. Mm-hmm. And a big part of it was getting Aqib Talib and saying, OK, you go cover the best receiver. Like, he was the start of that. And then they evolved to Revis, and then they evolved to Stephon Gilmore doing that. But Talib was the first guy that was really doing that for New England at the beginning of this decade. And he was awesome at it, put into some tough spots. But, you know, he was one of the guys that started that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Aqib Talib, early in his career, he always had this incredible talent. And it's like, why can't he just put it all together? It's a little bit like Stephon Gilmore in that regard. Like,
true.
It was always, he was obviously capable of more than he was showing. And for Talib, it was in Tampa. For Gilmore, it was in Buffalo. And then eventually, ironically, when they shift to New England, they both kind of get it, right? And then Talib ends up going on to Denver and becoming part of that no-fly zone where they had three legit cornerbacks capable of shutting down top-end receivers. But he was the guy taking the number one. He was the guy dominating in man coverage because of the size, the physicality, the ability to run with pretty much anybody. When he finally put it all together, he was a phenomenal cornerback for a while.
One of the other stories we've been posting this on social media the entire week, the PFF 101 and, you know, counting down and all that stuff. I haven't clicked on all of them. Sometimes I like to click and see how the people respond when they see a name on that list. And I did click on Chandler Jones, who came in at 80, former Patriot, Arizona Cardinal now. And he's also kind of the epitome of, you know, sustained consistency. Good, not great. He's got one grade above 90 as a pass rusher, but he's just got a ton of pressures and a ton of sacks.
So let's go through the list, right? Let's do this. Let's go one. Let's hit on all the names that'll piss people off, right, for their ranking, and explain why.
Do you
want to
just read the list?
No,
just read the list.
That's a Renner thing, and we'll do that later. Let's go through all the people that will like piss people off for specific rankings. Then let's go through and hit on sort of nostalgic names, you know, guys that popped up and it's like, wow, that guy was, it's worth remembering how good he was. And then we can end on some sort of comparison guys, like explain X being over Y, because I have a couple of those as well. So Chandler Jones is a good one, because Chandler Jones is the guy that everybody thinks PFF always hates because he gets a ton of sacks and we don't grade him particularly well. Like, he grades well, but not amazingly, not amongst the best pass rushers in the NFL. And part of that is because sacks aren't everything. Look, sacks are the thing that everybody is trying to achieve when you're rushing the passer. It's what you're trying to get to at the end. But pressure in and of itself is extremely valuable. Just pressuring the quarterback drops a passer rating on average by 35 points. So if you get a ton of pressure and you never sack the quarterback, you can still be a really valuable player. Now, with all the various data points that PFF has, we've been able to quantify like just how valuable sacks are, because obviously they're more valuable generally than a pressure. Sure, on a pressure, you can cause the quarterback to make an errant throw and it's a pick six, and that's an even worse play than a sack. But overall, sacks are worse plays for an offense than pressure is. But using our data, you can quantify just how much it is. And it's generally speaking about 2-1, right? A sack is worth 2 of any other type of pressure in broad strokes. So using that, you can start to piece together, okay, if a guy skews sack heavy, if he actually does have this trait of being able to finish plays more often than other players, how much more valuable is that? And even when you do that, Chandler Jones is not valuable enough that it offsets the fact that there are far more productive players when it comes to like win rate and how frequently they pressure the quarterback.
Can I say it differently too?
Sure.
It's not even a value thing with the sacks. It's just like, if you had to define what's the most difficult thing for a pass rusher, it's winning. It's defeating the block, right? Because that only happens 15% of the time. But then once that block is defeated, the sack happens 25% of the time, 30% of whatever that number is, right? What is it usually, the conversion?
15.
Is it close?
Yep.
It's usually a little bit higher. But winning one-on-ones is difficult. Winning them quickly happens 6% of the time, 7% of the time. So those are the things that we weigh the most. So like, the difficult thing is beating the guy one-on-one as a pass rusher. And then in theory, once that happens, finishing the play and turning it into a sack is a little bit easier. So Chandler Jones, 89th percentile in sack percentage since he came into the league, 36th out of 320 qualifiers. That's fantastic. But pass rush win percentage, only 78th percentile, 71st. So it just kind of shows he's not winning as often as other guys, but he is converting at a higher rate.
Yeah, well, I think there's...
He's a very good player.
There's also... So there's two parts to that, right? There's one, he doesn't win as often when it comes to rushing the passer as his sack rate would indicate. And then there's also the idea that not all sacks or pressures or hits are created equal, right? Some of them are decisive, dominant wins that come in 2 seconds and they're almost unstoppable from the point of view of an offense. And some of them are cleanup or pursuit, or they take 4 seconds of grinding to ultimately happen. And, you know, those are still important plays, but they don't earn as high a grade, right? Because that 4 seconds versus 2 seconds gives you a lot more time as an offense to mitigate it, to get rid of the ball, to make it not impact your team. So I think Jones generally has both of those things working against him if compared with what you would think if you just looked in terms of sack totals, right? If you look at just sack totals, he looks like one of the very, very best pass rushers in the NFL. But if you look at how often he wins and how many of those plays are the most dominant wins, in both of those categories, he doesn't show as well compared to some of the other pass rushers. And that's why he makes a list like wherever he is in the
80th.
Right. He makes a list of 80 as opposed to Von Miller, who is top 10. Right. There are two different ways of quantifying the difference between those two guys.
Also, the best thing that Jones does is his durability. Goes back to the Frank Gore thing. He's played over 1,000 snaps 3 different times. He's only played under 900 snaps once. Twice, 2012 and 2014. So his durability has been impressive. And again, why we don't like to focus on sack totals, like last year he had 19 by our count. No, don't know what the NFL had. He had over 600 pass rushes.
Right.
So how many times you're out there, how many opportunities you have does matter. He's rushed the passer over 500 times every year.
So
back to 2014.
For the decade, he's second in terms of sacks, right? NFL sacks, that is, the official half sack
right.
things. He's a little bit lower in ours. If you actually count them as full plays, he's fifth. But either way, top five in terms of sacks. But if you scroll down to win percentage, like he's not on the first page, and the first page has 50 guys on it. So,
right.
like he gets, you know what I mean? Where is he? He's down 76th. So he's 76th in terms of win rate as a pass rusher, but he's fifth in terms of how many plays he sacked the quarterback. It's just, we've talked for years, it's a bad way of measuring pass rushers, and it skews Chandler Jones positive. He's still been a fantastic player. He's in the top 101 players of the entire decade.
Right.
It's just,
he's
lower than you think he should be if you're judging him by sacks alone.
I really want to discuss Gerald McCoy and Ndamukong Suh because those guys together are just fascinating. But before we get to, do you want to wait on this, you know, this guy versus that guy, or do you want to
find another pain point type of guy that will piss people off because of where he is? Let's jump all the way to the top while we look for some more guys, because Evan Mathis is one of the perennial hot button PFF issues. Evan Mathis comes in at number 14, and honestly, number 14 is being about as generous as possible to everyone that hates him in terms of dinking him down the list. Like, he could have been higher based off his grade alone. You can take a little bit of it off for longevity and that kind of thing, because we didn't get a full decade's worth of play. But Evan Mathis was phenomenal. Basically, every single season we graded him. And it drives a lot of people nuts because he didn't do it in the way people want to see offensive linemen playing, right? You know, Jeff Schwartz has his series of pancake of the day, you know, take a guy, Quentin Nelson highlight reel type of stuff, right? Take a guy, bury him to the floor, teabag him on the way up, all this kind of stuff. That's what people want to see from an offensive lineman.
But hashtag happens, finish Friday.
Right, but that happens like a couple of times a game, right? And they're out there for 60-something snaps. So really, the differentiator between good and great is, what did you do on like the 55 snaps where nobody's paying attention? But you, did you slightly win? Did you move your guy slightly out of the intended point of attack, open up a crease for the running back? Or were you getting stood up and were you getting squeezed into the point of attack and causing the running back problems, you know, making him have to make decisions in the backfield that he doesn't have to make? And Mathis is just an exercise in consistently winning those mini battles snap after snap after snap and almost never losing, them. So it wasn't as spectacular as other linemen, but it was more efficient.
Yeah, I've used Evan Mathis because we have sit downs with coaches a lot and front office personnel. And there's a lot of, hey, explain the grades the same way the fans want to understand our grades. Coaches and people that have our data and are using our data, they want to understand it more and more. And Evan Mathis is one of the classic examples I use because, to your point, we track wins and losses, not just wins. Now, the actual wins probably create a little bit more value going forward, but not losing as often as Evan Mathis didn't lose, as often as he just was in the right position, especially in, say, like a zone blocking scheme where you're almost just trying to, like, just don't lose your gap, right? Just don't lose. Just don't lose leverage. Just don't, to your point, force the running back somewhere else. From a run game perspective, Evan Mathis was incredible at that. And, you know, it was just, hey, look at him. Hands inside the frame of the defender. Technique was awesome. And he just executed over and over and over again. I love that Mathis is at 14 and Chris Harris is at 12 because PFF started to become kind of a thing in the public sphere like 2009-ish, and it grew from there. And those were two of our first guys, so to speak, that we highlighted that the masses probably weren't aware about. Chris Harris, hey, he's just a slot corner. But like when you grade that well year after year after year, after a while, you know, we start to give you proper credit and then the league catches on and people catch on. And Evan Mathis was the same thing. So, yeah, we still debate people in the league about how good Evan Mathis was. But I think it's still because coaches come from a different perspective. And, you know, being great on 62 out of 64 plays sometimes is overrated even for them when they see, you know, the three or four great ones maybe that you have in a game. So Mathis was just a prime example of every play matters. Every play counts when you're grading these guys.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, he's also, when he went back, as much as there's a lot of those guys, those offensive line people that didn't like him again, because he didn't have the finish plays, the splash plays. When you go back and watch him play, he was just always in the right place. Like you say, he didn't lose, yeah. Always made his block, always generate a little bit of movement. It was just exactly what it should look like.
But it's also, it's not like the spectacular stuff, too, isn't like take your man and drive him 12 yards down the field. I mean, that literally happens, you know, 10 times a year. With Mathis, too, it was still, he's quick off the ball, backside of zone. He was making backside cutoffs and various things that were difficult to do. I mean, he made difficult blocks, but maybe not the ones that you're putting on a highlight reel. Like, hey, watch this pancake where the dude tripped over a defensive lineman. Offensive linemen are real sensitive about when they trip, but not when the defensive lineman trips. You know what I mean? It's pancake, right? What about Casey Hayward being so high on this list at 24?
Yes. So Casey Hayward is a good one. I think three cornerbacks make sense to be talked of at the same time. Casey Hayward, really high, one spot below Darrell Revis. And then Brent Grimes versus Patrick Peterson. Because that's another one that's pissing a lot of people off.
Oh, yeah. Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So here's the thing, right? Let's Casey Hayward first. Casey Hayward hit the league in 2012 and had maybe the greatest statistical season we've ever seen from a cornerback when he was covering the slot as a rookie for Green Bay. It was pretty much insane. And he had a kind of similar career to Chris Harris in terms of consistently playing so well in the role he was given that he earned a better role and just kept getting, you know, going bigger and bigger. So you start off and you're a slot guy only, and then it's, wow, this guy is so good covering the slot. We should probably find out if he can play outside because that's more valuable. And if he can, we get even more out of him. So Hayward basically convinces somebody else. I mean, the Packers didn't really want to give him that opportunity to play outside. So,
no, they didn't want him at all.
Right. He goes to the Chargers, gets converted into a legit number one cornerback on the outside and continues to play every bit as good as he did when he was covering the slot and doing a really good job. So he's just consistently been one of the best cornerbacks in the NFL since he came into the league. And I think, what was it? Is it the best forced incompletion rate or certainly one of the best over the entire decade?
I think it's top. Yeah.
Let me check.
I think it's
that.
Number one.
Yeah, the best forced incompletion rate of any cornerback in the decade. So that's not just pass breakups and interceptions, but it's, you know, hits that dislodge the ball. It's where you cut off a guy you know, and don't let him get to the ball in his route, all these kind of things. These sort of subtle ways of causing incompletions that aren't necessarily pass breakups. He was just one of the best players at stopping receivers catching the ball.
I mean, so the debate, you said it's Brent Grimes versus Patrick Peterson, but even just Casey Hayward versus Patrick Peterson, right? I'm looking at Casey Hayward's page. Ah, he's 5'11", 192, and runs a 4.57, right? I mean, it's like Patrick Peterson is really, really good. And when he's asked to play man coverage, he's one of the few guys who can hang with the Julio Joneses of the world and, you know, the better receivers who are making plays down the field. But his actual production hasn't been as good. Plus, you always make the point, Sam, like zone coverage matters. Like your ability to play off coverage, your ability to read route concepts, make plays on the ball. Like that's Casey Hayward to a T, and that's Chris Harris. Again, like those guys do everything really well. Since Hayward has come into the league, one of the best coverage grades in the entire NFL, 98th percentile there. He is at the top echelon of cornerbacks in pretty much every category. And to your point, he's in the top echelon when lined up outside, when lined up in the slot, when his defensive line's not getting pressure. He still has one of the best coverage grades. So Casey Hayward is another kind of classic PFF guy where, look, we've got thousands of snaps of data that just say this guy's really, really good. It just doesn't matter that he's 5'11 and runs a 4.57. He just gets the job done over and over again.
Peterson is a client. Well, yeah, so you're right. There's this general perception that being like a man cover corner is just a better thing than being a zone cover corner. But ultimately, they're playing the same position, just in a different style. And in today's NFL, almost nobody plays man coverage more often than they're playing zone coverage. Like zone coverage, A, is more prevalent, and B, has a lot of man concepts in it anyway. Like they're not this linear, straight, hard line between the two of them. But this idea of like, well, if you're not playing man coverage every single snap the way Darrell Revis used to, you're not really playing cornerback. You're just sort of being hidden by the defense. That's a bad way of looking at it. So if that's your starting point, we're already coming at this from completely different places. The other thing is Peterson represents this interesting thing of, you know, for years it was Patrick Peterson versus Richard Sherman or Richard Sherman versus Darrell Revis. You know, those two have a beef going on. And a lot of it is the job you're being given, right? Darrell Revis and Patrick Peterson is one of the few players that's had this role where you track the best receiver and you follow him wherever he goes, left, right, slot, whatever. You track him and you are one-on-one man coverage at that guy all game long. And that is undoubtedly the hardest role, the hardest assignment in coverage in the NFL. But Richard Sherman's point has always been, well, okay, but you need to be good enough for that to be a net win, right? Like if you're Darrell Revis, fine, because you can legitimately still be a shutdown corner in that role, and that is a huge win for your defense. But if you're not Revis and you're getting beat more because you have that harder role, is that a net win for your defense versus doing what the Seahawks did to Sherman and just playing him on one side and letting him erase that guy, whoever it is, and then rolling coverage away from him and taking advantage of it that way? His opinion has always been no. Look, if you're not of a certain level, it's not a good thing. And I think Patrick Peterson is the guy that would make you question whether it was a good thing for him. So he had one of the hardest jobs in the NFL for a period of time. He also didn't do it for a lot of time and didn't erase guys when he had that role. So Peterson has given up the third most touchdowns of any cornerback in the past decade. Like he got beaten a lot, at which point you can only boost him so high for the fact that he had a harder job than other guys.
Yeah, I think you nailed it right there. And that's the thing with Peterson. I mean, he's similar to Chandler Jones, too. I feel like either we're explaining away stats or we're explaining, I'm looking at Patrick Peterson's page. He's 6'1". He runs a 4.3, and he's a very good player. Again, he's in the 80th percentile, 87th percentile in all these top categories against everyone else since coming into the league. He's fantastic. And he's had some really peak seasons, too. He's had some of those peak seasons where guys were afraid of him, and he did track and do that, you know, do the Revis type thing and did it at a pretty good level. I mean, your point's good too. Like if I had my choice, I would take 2009 Darrell Revis. Like if I knew that I'm getting a guy that could take every receiver out, take away the best, the favorite option of the opposing quarterback, and they're still going to force it his way, and he's going to give up, you know, 39% completions. Like, I would choose that.
Yeah.
With but that, nobody, I mean, but nobody's able to do it at that level.
That's like saying, yeah, that's like saying I would choose, you know, that's like saying I would choose the best Randy Moss season of all time. Every like that's obviously the gold standard. But even Darrell Revis wasn't 2009 Darrell Revis for most of his career. Like, that is an unrealistic, unattainable target of what you want. So the question actually becomes, if you can't have that, what do you actually want, right? Do you want a bad imitation of that, or do you want taking that guy and putting him in an easier role so that he performs better and you can take advantage of other things? And even just when you look at the... So it's unquestionable that Patrick Peterson, for most of his career, has had a harder job, a harder assignment than Richard Sherman. But then you start looking at what impact that had on what they actually gave up. And
you know, how well you do it matters, right?
Which is the same thing, right? So Peterson has given up 6 percentage points more in terms of completion rate than Sherman. He's given up like 35 points more in terms of passer rating when targeted. He's given up a ton more touchdowns. He's had a fraction of the interceptions. Like, in every measurable way of playing cornerback, he wasn't in the same ballpark. And then the question is how close... So their data puts them here, right? And then the question is how, or, you know, the data puts them a certain distance apart from each other. And then you have to ask yourself, how much does Peterson's more difficult role elevate him towards guys like Sherman and Revis? And I think the answer is just not close enough.
And here's the one other point. I don't want this to sound like baseball arbitration where you've got this really good player and you find every bad thing about him. but with Patrick Peterson, 24th percentile coverage grade in the slot. So, like, when they did have to put him into the slot, I mean, just last year, you see Emmanuel Sanders is running simple routes on him and Peterson's fallen over. Like, when they did put him in the slot, it wasn't just to the detriment of the, like, it was against the rest of the league. Like, he was bad when he has to cover the slot when he plays there. So he's good at what he does and when he's asked to do what he does, which is why Peterson made the list, but a little bit further down, which does bring us to the guy that was above him, Brent Grimes. And, you know, you talk about nostalgic. It's only a few years ago, but a few years ago, Brent Grimes was one of the league's best pretty consistently.
Absolutely. Brent Grimes is the perfect example of, I mean, so not, he wasn't as good as Richard Sherman, but it's the same idea, right? He was a fantastic zone cornerback. And the question is, how much do you dismiss what he did because he did it only in his own defense? And we don't rate that as coverage. That's just hiding a cornerback, right? I mean, I just think that's a fundamentally silly way of looking at this. Brent Grimes was a really, really good zone corner who was able to make plays, who was able to stop people catching the ball. People just don't give that credit because it happened in a system that we think of as protecting cornerbacks.
Yeah, Grimes, man, he played big at the catch point. He did a lot of things really, really well for a while. And he had, you know, his publicist. What's her name?
His wife. Miko.
Yeah, his publicist always trying to talk him up.
Yeah.
God, she thought that we hated him. Well, she thought everybody hated him.
Yes.
But we always graded him well. Always graded him well. Where else are you getting the hate, Sam? Where else is the hate coming from in this list here?
Larry Fitzgerald, 47 overall. We're hating Larry Fitzgerald.
We're hating him?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. I mean, when I think of Larry, first off, his peak was last decade. Like, his real peak was last decade.
Yeah.
So if we were including 2004 through now, he's awesome. Or 03 was his rookie season?
Yeah.
How long has he been around?
Like, two decades.
Like, when he really burst onto the scene was that Super Bowl run in 2008 where people are like, oh, wow, Larry Fitzgerald's one of the best receivers in the NFL. How about that?
Which, he again, does it all. He's so good. This decade.
That was 2008, so before this decade. The fact that he's even at 47, I think, is a testament to just how good he's been, because he is the description that we gave of Chandler Jones, his teammate, of just being, like, very good throughout the entire decade.
Right, and that's the thing. He's an exercise in the Chandler Jones and the Frank Gore, the compiling end of things, right? Because he's one of, I think, three players to have 10,000-plus receiving yards in this decade, which is fantastic. But again, it's like... that's not necessarily dominant, right? it's certainly dominant for stretches, but if you work it out mathematically what that is, you know, in a given game, it's not that much, right? It's just being very good for an extremely long period of time. Now, I think that there's an argument to be made in terms of most of the decade, he had a pretty crappy quarterback situation. Like, we had a brief middle with Carson Palmer playing at an MVP level for 1 year, playing okay a couple of years either side of that. We had like a cameo from Kevin Cobb where he looked like he might be useful. And then we had last year with Kyler Murray being okay, pretty good for a rookie. But generally speaking, he's had, I think, one of the worst quarterback situations that any, you know, long-standing receiver has had to deal with. So you can definitely boost him up for that. But yeah, I think Larry Fitzgerald all time will go down for as being one of the best in the NFL. But for the last decade, I don't see how you can put him in the category of guys like Julio, like Antonio Brown, you know, the very best receivers in that decade.
Yeah, and with Larry, he got little rejuvenation from Bruce Arians coming into Arizona. They moved him inside to the slot. Arians likes to take his big receivers, and you know, we talked about this with Gronk. He likes to take his big receivers, bring them close to the formation, put them into run, you know, expect a little bit more from them from a run blocking standpoint, all these different things. That really helped his career as well. He's because he's kind of evolved into more of this possession slot type in recent years. So yeah, his longevity has been spectacular. And then we always talk about stable and unstable metrics here. You know, what can you count on year to year? And usually drop rates are all over the place. You see Amari Cooper has 18 1 year and four the next. Not Larry Fitzgerald. Drop rate is as stable as it gets with him. I can't believe he's only dropped, what, 27 passes the entire decade? That's insane.
I mean, I think
that's two seasons for some guys.
He has a case to have to go down as like maybe the best hands in NFL history. Certainly the best hands of the last decade. He's got, I think, the best drop rate of any receiver in that time. He just does not drop passes. And that is a huge thing in his favor as well.
Body control, tracking ability. He's got like the list of wide receiver traits that are kind of like subtle and you just kind of know it when you see it. Like, that's Larry Fitzgerald. And, you know, speed isn't really one of them. He just does everything else really, really well, which 47 is a good spot for him. Best of the decade, Sam. That's a good spot.
Right.
I mean, what else are people mad about?
So, you know, one of the things that, so he's got 10,000 yards. It's like he's got like 400 more than Demaryius Thomas, who I don't think anybody would particularly care if he was on this list or not, right? It's just, again, not the best way of measuring these things, just overall compiling numbers. What else is people mad about? So some people were mad that Peyton Manning was as low as 18. And again, like this, you have to remember this, the time frame we're working on here, right? Manning missed an entire season in 2011, injured, right? Retired after 2015, so the last 4 years of the decade he didn't play. In 2015, he was injured and bad for most of it, the year where he got a second ring, and yet still makes the list in the top 20 because the other few years in there were so absurdly good that it
boosts him that really high. Good seasons.
Right.
Like, four really good seasons are what put him on there. So, like, having him as high as 18, maybe a tribute to 18.
That's exactly it. And you're talking about a guy who basically 60% of the decade was working against him, and he still made the top 20. Like, that is something to be celebrated, not complaining about.
Similarly, you know, Khalil Mack's right ahead of him at 17. And, you know, Khalil Mack, season for season, is kind of right there with Von Miller. But Von Miller's way higher because he started in 2011. Khalil Mack started in 2014, this decade. He's essentially working with a similar time frame as Peyton, so they land in a similar spot. I thought the quarterbacks, there was definitely, you know, we'll get into the top guys, but throughout PFF's history, back to 2006, there's a clear tier of Tom Brady, Drew Brees, Aaron Rodgers, and Peyton Manning. And, you know, this decade as well, that is the clear top tier. The next grouping, though, we have Matt Ryan and Russell Wilson at 32 and 33. I think that's fair to kind of say, hey, that next tier is Matt Ryan, Russell Wilson, Ben Roethlisberger, and Phillip Rivers. I mean, that's just what – I mean, and whether you go by traditional stats or PFF grade, they've kind of merged together over time. I think that's a very fair top eight in two different tiers of quarterbacks over the last decade and even the last, you know, 15 years or so.
I'm just looking through this list now to see if there's any more we've gotten immense hate about.
You mentioned Darrell Revis. He's at 23, and he's similar, right? Like, his best season just missed the decade. If you just tacked his 09 season into this decade breakdown, he's probably top 10 just on that season alone. But we put him at 23 because the first half of the decade, for the most part, he was really, really good. But he only played half the decade, and at the end, he wasn't the same Darrell Revis.
Yeah, absolutely. No, you're right. I mean, those are guys who, look, if this was just a best player we've seen, those guys would be top five, but it's not. It's best play in the decade that we've just seen, and those guys didn't have enough of their top play within that decade. You know, they're the best parts of their career. I mean, arguable Peyton Manning, given his resurgence, happened in the previous decade. Manning, right. I mean, we talked about it before, like him completely remodeling his play on the fly when he came back from injury and realized that he wasn't the same guy physically anymore is one of the most impressive things I've ever seen a pro athlete do. He basically calculated three interceptions in that, I can't make that throw anymore and I can never make it again. So I'm going to have to change how I'm playing quarterback. And this was like week two of an NFL season. That, like, you know, players try and work on their mechanics and it fundamentally breaks them and they're never the same guy again. Like Manning, in the middle of a game, changed the way he plays football and not only like survived to a decent level and hung on for a few more years, like he had a 5,455 touchdown season after that. Like he changed himself and became as good as he'd ever been before. That is, you cannot say enough good things about that, in my opinion.
Yeah, it was unexpected. I mean, people really didn't know what to expect from Peyton Manning going to the Denver Broncos and in a new situation. And he had a 3-year stretch, 2012, 13 was that peak with all the touchdowns, and 14 statistically was great. Then you started to see some of the wear and tear at the end of 2014 and into the playoffs. And then the cliff happened in 2015. But yes, that turning around of his career was one of the biggest stories at the, you know, at the outset of the decade here. Any other names, Sam?
Russell Wilson's ranking appears to be attracting a ton of hate, both good and bad, which makes me think he's in the right place. So there's a ton of people that think he's too low. There's a ton of people that think he's too high. We have him ranked, 33? And I think, look, this is the whole decade, right? So Russell Wilson, the past couple of seasons, I think it's been as good as any quarterback in the NFL. But that wasn't always true.
He's got one season in the top three. Like last year, he was our top quarterback for the majority of the season. The most valuable quarterback, but it's not like he's been an annual top three or top five guy, whether it's WAR or PFF grade. Not an annual thing.
I think last season was the first year where we were like the terrible Russell Wilson game that seems to come like every eight games of his career didn't show up. Like we were waiting for it. Right. Like he's had that run before where he's been incredible for a big stretch of time. It's just that it's almost always followed by like a terrible game. That's like, you see that all the haters go, see, that's why he's not as good as Rodgers or as good as Breeze or as good as Brady. And like what made last year so amazing is that never showed up. Like we were waiting for it all season long and it never came. But those games are the reason that he hasn't been the same player he was last year through the entirety of his career. He's been a really great quarterback and last year showed you what he's capable of, but let's not have some rose tinted glasses and rewrite history here. Like there was some bad in there as well.
Yeah. Like I said, I think even if you look at, so just using PFF grades as an example, if you go back through the last decade and you take the top 50 PFF grades, half of them are those top four quarterbacks, Brady, Breeze, Rodgers, and Peyton. They have half of the top grades. There's a clear line, I think, with those guys. And then if you take the rest of them, 90% of the top 50 PFF passing grades of the decade are made up of the top four plus Wilson, Ryan, Roethlisberger, and Rivers. And then now you have guys like Patrick Mahomes has a couple in there, and Lamar has one, and then there's the outliers like Carson Wentz has one, and Eli has one, and Derek Carr has one, and Carson Palmer has one, and Cam Newton has one. I mean, that's it. I mean, so there's a top four, and then there's a next four from a consistency standpoint. I think it's actually next five. Andrew Luck's in there as well, but he gets docked a little bit, obviously, by injury and missing seasons and retiring, right? So there's a clear top nine quarterbacks, I'd say, of the decade from a, you know, what was your peak standpoint. And Russell Wilson's clearly in that group. Russell Wilson, Matt Ryan, Ben Roethlisberger, and Philip Rivers are in that next tier. That's why they're all on the list. And then Ryan and Wilson are just a little bit above Roethlisberger and Rivers from that perspective. And no Eli Manning, sorry.
No Eli Manning.
Speaking of Hall of Famers.
Yeah. All right, what about right, guys?
Any other name hate?
No, I think that's it for all the people that we got wrong, according to everybody else. Let's look at guys that you were happy to sort of see, like memory lane people that you were pleased to see pop up. You want me to go first?
Well, you mentioned – yeah, you go ahead.
Charles Tillman. Charles Peanut Punch Tillman. Again, guy who, like, not that much of his career crept into this decade, but he was still really, really good when he was there. And this is a guy who basically pioneered this approach of literally targeting the ball. I'm going to let you catch it. I'm a zone corner, so I'm being dismissed as in a scheme that protects cornerbacks. But he brought something else to the table. He was like, I'm going to let you catch the ball in front of me, and then I'm going to come up and target it. I'm going to punch it out. And like, even this decade, I think he forced something like 27 fumbles. It's just nuts. Like, his ability to target the ball and get it out is, I don't think any cornerback in NFL history has done that better.
A peanut punch, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he was special in that Chicago scheme. Because, early in the decade, they were, Lovie Smith, it's cover two, you've got Urlacher. They kind of had some prototypes in that defense, right? You had Urlacher was the prototype for a cover two middle linebacker. Lance Briggs was the Derek Brooks will for a big chunk of his career, chase and run all over the place. And Charles Tillman was the perfect zone corner who could play. You knew how to play with his eyes on the quarterback, and to your point, tackle and force fumbles and create big plays. I mean, there were definitely some years where that Chicago Bears defense was fantastic because of players like him. Troy Polamalu, for me, to the point where when I saw his name, I was like, wait a second, let me look back at this thing. What did he do this decade? Because I still mostly remember the 2008 Steelers that won the Super Bowl. That was one of the best defenses, I think, of all time. They went on a stretch of absolute domination. But Polamalu hasn't played since 2014, but he still ranked in 2010. He was the number one graded safety in 2011, 10th in 2012, and 7th in 2013. And sorry, 9th in 2010. So he was a top 10 safety every year, right? Including the number one mark in 2011. And just the way, remember, it used to be Polamalu versus Ed Reed, like who's the better player? And they played two completely different roles, which made the debate, you know, something you probably shouldn't debate, but it was fun either way. Nobody played safety like Polamalu did. Like nobody did. He would be at the line of scrimmage when he's supposed to be playing deep cover two. And he would just do it. He would just kind of disguise and do whatever he wanted. And, you know, every now and again he got burned because of it, but he was just, oh man, hashtag fun to watch, Troy.
Yeah, the other thing that's worth mentioning is that the playoffs counted in this, right? So if you were a guy that had an extended or a serious amount of sort of extra playoff play, that could give you a serious boost up this list. Like if you played multiple seasons.
Brady.
Right, it helps Brady. It helps guys, you know, it helps any of those players that had a ton of postseason play that was still as good as their other play. You know, you could overcome a lot of lack of playing time if you had some playoff bonus as well. Yeah, Polamalu, great player. Anytime you can remember him is good. A few guys that I think are sort of underrated, but it was good to see them pop up on this list. Tamba Hali, I think, gets forgotten about in terms of great pass rushes in the past decade. Hali had the PFF record in terms of total pressures in a single season until J.J. Watt came along. So at his best, I think he was a really, really great pass rusher. And again, like, there were a lot of people pissed off that Tamba Hali was a couple of spots ahead of Chandler Jones because Jones did it for longer, compiled more numbers. But Hali's peak is something that Chandler Jones has never approached, even with that big sack season that he had. Like, Tamba Hali's peak was genuinely fantastic.
Yeah, that's what his peak is, what gets him there. A guy like James Harrison makes the list because of his peak as well. He was one of the best pass rushers year in, year out. At the beginning of the decade. I think there's a good balance here, Sam. Carlos Dunlap is another one of those Chandler Jonesy type of guys where you go back. He hasn't had the crazy sack totals that Jones has had. But when you go back, it's like, wow, you've been this good for this long. Not a nostalgic name, but again, when I go up and down the list, I'm like, oh, here's a guy with a 5-year peak. Here's a guy with 10 years of good. I mean, it's just a good balance, I think, on the list. I think Jamaal Charles, too, is the other one from a nostalgia standpoint. Yeah, running backs don't matter, but man, when you average 5.3 yards per carry, you're pretty close, right?
Yeah, I mean, Jamaal Charles was great. Again, he's the other end of the scale from the compiling guys. He's, you know, how short a career where you were exceptionally good can still propel you up there. There's a couple of offensive linemen, I think, that are interesting to see pop up. Josh Sitton, who was by far the best pass-blocking guard of his generation. Like, he, I think, had multiple NFL seasons where he allowed fewer than 10 total pressures in the year. Like, you know, obviously, there's 16 games a year, so he's allowing significantly. He's basically allowing half a pressure a game or a pressure every other game for, like, I think, 3 seasons in the decade. That's nuts. Like, you could genuinely forget about his spot. His guy was not going to get pressure on the quarterback, and that is obviously hugely valuable. And then Nick Mangold, who, again, did not play that much of the decade, but was so good even in his last few seasons that he's ranked up on this list.
You wrote that he perfectly split decades, right?
I think so. I think he was almost exactly – like, he's that guy that we've talked about who's,
yeah,
you know, one of the best players to ever play at his position, but almost exactly split 2 different decades.
So let's discuss a little Ndamukong Suh and Gerald McCoy, this guy versus that guy as well. I mean, those guys, if we go back to 2010, the 2010 NFL draft was slam dunk Sam Bradford, number one overall. There's no debate. We had Ndamukong Suh coming off of one of the greatest seasons. This was great. I mean, I wasn't with PFF at the time. I remember thinking about, why is there even a debate between Ndamukong Suh and Gerald McCoy at the time? Because Sue was coming off one of the best seasons in college football history. He had just sacked Colt McCoy 4 times in the Big 12 championship, and Texas still managed to pull off the win somehow, right? Sue was a dominant creature along the defensive front, right? Strength, quickness, hand usage, everything was spectacular. And then you have Gerald McCoy, who always got a lot of hype as a great player. He was like he was your prototypical 3 technique. He's just going to, you know, burst into the backfield. He's got that great first step, and he's not going to put up crazy. He didn't put up crazy numbers at Oklahoma, but he was the guy everybody talked about. Like, Oklahoma had this run of Tommy Harris, and, you know, and just he was being compared to Tommy Harris, who was, like, again, the prototypical 3 technique. And you're going into the 2010 draft, and it's like Sam Bradford's number one, and Ndamukong Suh's probably number two. But then you had, like, Mike Mayock, I think, slid in late. He's like, no, keep an eye on Gerald McCoy. He might be number two. And there was, like, legitimate debate between Suh and McCoy, and they go 2 and 3 in the draft. And 10 years later, we're sitting here, and they're 0.1 apart in PFF grade. I just love that. Sam Bradford's not good and retired, and, you know, I still believe in him. But Suh and McCoy are sitting here 0.1 apart in PFF grade, and now at 71 and 72 on the all-decade team right next to each other. I just love that. I love that story. Different players, different career paths, all that stuff, but they're close in overall grade.
And always have been. It's kind of amazing how consistently both guys have been. You know, both guys became really, really good NFL players. They became guys that can rank in the top 101 of the decade. They were always consistently among the better defensive linemen in the NFL, and yet neither one of them became the Aaron Donald that people were sort of billing both of them as in that process. Obviously, you know, not many people become Aaron Donald, but neither of them really became the best interior guy in the NFL during their careers. I think McCoy generally has been a better pass rusher, and Suh has been a better run defender, or been has had more durability, more snaps, more, you know, more everything. But McCoy is the guy with the more devastating peak, I think.
Sue's durability has just been ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, we've discussed that before too, but he's got 2 years as an interior defensive lineman, never played fewer than 800 snaps, 2 years over 1,000. He's now done it with 4 different teams. The other thing that we've discussed before, too, is at Detroit, he had pretty good sack totals and pressure numbers. But when he went to Miami, on snap-for-snap basis, was just as good, if not better. But he had pretty much had 2 peak years in Detroit. and just better and more consistent all around years in Miami. And now he's still sitting in the league as probably more of a role player, but a guy that last year also played 874 snaps once again, even at the tail end of likely the tail end of his career. McCoy's peak spectacular too, where he did show flash. He wasn't Aaron Donald. Nobody was. You said it, but his peak was pretty close. Him and Geno Atkins, they both have like that 1 or 2 years where it's like, oh, this is, here's this unblockable dude. And then the rest has been, you know, really good outside of that. Were there any other individual stories? I think we should break down the top 10 or like the top 12 or 13, cause they're all superstars.
So one that people wanted to, Luke Kuechly versus Bobby Wagner. They've always been seen as like 1A, basically the same guy. And yet we have Kuechly way up at the top and Wagner a little bit further down.
Yeah. So Wagner just started slower in this respect, right? I mean, that debate didn't start. Let me pull up Wagner's page, but that debate didn't start until like 2015 or 16, where they were the clear top two. Luke Kuechly played a little out of position as a rookie, had some ups and downs. But that was 2012. And then from 2013 on, he was spectacular. Mm-hmm. Wagner's spectacular play, he was really good as a rookie, 84 grade. And then three not as good grades. And then from 16, 17, and 18 was outstanding in the blue, so to speak, 86, 91, 91. So Wagner's peak started later than Kuechly's. He started out hot, slowed down a little bit, and then had a 3-year stretch where he was right there with Kuechly.
Right.
Kuechly never really slowed down after his rookie season.
And in particular in coverage, like coverage is where both guys became absolutely spectacular. And Bobby Wagner's spectacular coverage play basically lasted 2 seasons. Like Kuechly was a top percentile difference maker in coverage for like six straight years. So I think there's a significant difference between the two of them overall in the decade in terms of coverage, if not at their peak.
And Kuechly has 5 years of 90-plus grades. Wagner has two. Kuechly has 6 years of 85-plus. Wagner has three. So again, taking the whole decade into account, if you've listened to us over the last few years, we've always put them together because over the last 3 or 4 years, they've been the top
That's
two guys.
They've been the same.
But Kuechly started earlier as far as being in that, you know, top linebacker conversation in the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
I like looking at the top 11. It's all guys that you're like, these are future Hall of Famers or stars. Not to knock Chris Harris at 12. I don't know if he's a future Hall of Famer because I don't know how they're going to handle slot corners. But even at 13, it's Antonio Brown. 11, you get to Joe Thomas, Kuechly at 10, J.J. Watt at 9, just because, you know, durability-wise, like, he should be a top three guy this decade if he didn't have durability issues, Sam.
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, Watt is another one. It's like, it's good to remember what he was before the injury started to set in, and that's obviously what's keeping him as high on this list. Like, J.J. Watt, Luke Kuechly is one of the greatest linebackers to ever play the game, and J.J. Watt is one spot above him, because he had a 4-year stretch that's unlike anything we've ever seen, at least pre-Aaron Donald. And I think people might use Aaron Donald to sort of dismiss J.J. Watt a little bit. It's like, well, we thought he was generational, and then here comes Aaron Donald 3 years later. It's possible that two complete, you know, all-time generational talents come along 3 years apart. Like, in theory, the idea is those guys come along once in a generation, like once every 15, 20 years. But that's just like, you know, the same way that flipping a coin should come up 50-50 either way. They can come up tails 10 times in a row. It's just those are the way things work sometimes.
Also the same way Lawrence Taylor, Bruce Smith, and Reggie White all played football at the same time, right? Those guys, Derek Thomas, like there was a point where all four of those guys were in the league at the same time, right? There was crossover between those four.
Yeah.
You'd almost, and I might be missing a guy from that generation that was generational, but you know, those guys are like the pinnacle of all around pass rushers and edge rushers, right?
Yeah. So we need to like remember just how good J.J. Watt was at his best. And one of the things, he still has the NFL record in terms of total pressures in a season. So two players have topped 100 over the course of a single season, Aaron Donald and J.J. Watt. Donald did it in 2018. Now, you can argue that Donald doing it from a pure interior alignment as opposed to Watt, who split time inside and outside back in 2014. There's a difference, and I wouldn't argue with you. Donald won at a higher rate and did it from inside and blah, blah, blah. But like two guys who topped 100, J.J. Watt ended up at 119. Like he is 13 higher than anybody else has ever managed. Like 13 is two good games of pressure. And what did that? What is that far clear of anybody else? That was a season where, you know, again, like Donald, 20 and a half NFL sacks, 21 times sacking the quarterback. He also hit the quarterback that year 44 times. So the dude knocked him down, what is that, 65 times in a season? That's just nuts.
Yeah. Watt was spectacular. Donald's taken it to a new level. Watt also essentially did change positions, right? He was doing it from the interior. Yeah. They moved him to the edge. He had that ability. He also played the run. We talk all about the pass game, but Donald plays the run too, but Watt played the run at a special way too. Dude, there were plays. You know, Donald would shoot into the backfield, right? And just not be blocked. But there were plays where Watt would beat his man so quickly. You'd see him already past the lineman in like in position for a tackle while the running back's receiving the handoff. I mean, you'd see that a few times per year where he just would whoop a dude so bad, he's just waiting. I'm going to go make the play, and I'm going to make it a couple gaps over.
Yeah, so that's the thing, right? He would also do it in the wrong gap. Like, he would essentially fake one way and then jump to the wrong gap and go the long way around his lineman because he knew he could beat him so fast that he could essentially play run defense from the wrong gap and still make tackles in the backfield. That season, by the way, where he had 119 pressures, he also had 10 batted passes, which I'm pretty sure led the league that year. Like, that was the other thing, is for a period, he was this batting pass machine who just getting double-digit batted passes, which are essentially pass breakups, you know, for defensive backs. Like, he's up there with the best defensive backs in the NFL in terms of pass breakups with just batting them down the line in addition to, like, getting 120 pressures in a season. It's just, like, his peak was just outrageous.
All right, let's keep working through the top 10. Julio Jones comes in at 8. Throughout his career, we've debated Julio Jones, DeAndre Hopkins, Odell Beckham had like a year and a half where he was in that conversation. Antonio Brown, I think it's mostly been Julio Jones or Antonio Brown throughout the majority of the decade. We have AB at 13 and Julio at 8. He has been, there was a point where Calvin Johnson did make the list because his top end play was spectacular, but Julio gets into the league in 2011 and he's been pretty great ever since he got here.
Yeah, so he's one of the players that benefits from the fact that his entire career essentially has been within the decade almost perfectly. So he has that working for him. And simply put, he's been the most productive receiver in the NFL over that period of time. He leads the NFL in receiving yardage in that period, and he leads up like 1,000. Like, Antonio Brown's the next guy there, and he's got 1,000 more yards. Now, obviously, Antonio Brown basically didn't play last year, so that'll help. But also in terms of yards per route run, like, he's led that statistical category, I think, 4 straight years in PFF's tracking of it. He's been top 5 another 2 years. Like, he has been the guy that has gained the most yardage for every snap he's been out there running a route over the past decade.
Yeah, pretty unstoppable at all levels of the field, right? That's the way I like to describe
Julio. And by the way, when you hit the postseason, Julio's play kicks up another notch as well. Like, he's had phenomenal postseasons.
Yeah, if the Falcons didn't blow the 28-3 lead, the Julio catch that he made in that game is one of the, I mean, it already is one of the best catches in Super Bowl history, but that becomes like the helmet catch. That becomes like one of the top 10 plays in NFL history, potentially, because it should have clinched the Super Bowl for Atlanta. That was one of the best catches we've seen of the entire decade, happened in the Super Bowl in the fourth quarter in crunch time. So Julio at 8, Von Miller at 7, another guy that comes in that class. Man, that 2011 draft class was unbelievable, wasn't it? J.J. Watt, Julio Jones, Von Miller at 7, another guy who benefits from the whole decade and just pure consistency, rushing the passer and playing the run.
Yeah, there's been nobody better as a pure pass rusher than Von Miller. He had 8 straight seasons with a PFF grade above 90 to start his career. That in and of itself is nuts. He leads the NFL in total pressures over the decade by 40. He's got one of the best win rates, one of the best pressure rates. He has just been the prototype in terms of speed, edge rushers, pass rushing, He's been the gold standard. He's been the guy that everybody has measured pass rushers against over the entirety of the last decade. Some guys, whether it's Khalil Mack, people have joined him every now and again where he is, but nobody's ever done it over the whole time the way he has. Now, last season was the first season of his career where this grade dropped below 90, and it dropped quite a way below 90, dropped below 80. So it'll be interesting to see if next year he bounces back or if last year was the start of his decline. But like, that was a decade span that few players have been able to match at any position.
We had Aaron Rodgers at number six, the third quarterback on the list behind Brady and Breeze.
This pissed off the math nerds, Ben Baldwin, the analytics guys. They don't like it.
Is he already mad?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, Rodgers, first off, started the decade incredibly. 2010, the Super Bowl happens this decade. So his Super Bowl win, where he was awesome in that game against the Pittsburgh Steelers. And then I would say Aaron Rodgers peaks, the way he played football in 2011, the way he played football in 2014 for probably 80-90% of the season. And then there was that stretch in 2016 as well. There are peaks of play that are some of the best, some of the best quarterback play we've ever seen. And that all happened this decade. So, I think Rodgers certainly hasn't had the consistency of, say, Brady and Breeze in that respect, but his high-end play is absolutely as good as it gets.
Yeah, I think, again, recency bias. We're in danger of underrating what Aaron Rodgers did because of what he is right now. And there was a decent period of time where Aaron Rodgers was seen as Patrick Mahomes. He was the most talented quarterback that had ever played the position. He was doing things we had never seen before and playing at a consistent level that we had just never seen. Exactly like Patrick Mahomes is right now. And then things started to slowly erode and he got into, Baker Mayfield lent into all of his negatives last season and they just immediately became a massive problem. Rodgers did it over a much longer and slower period of time. He just sort of bit by bit, step by step, started to lean into the negatives in his game. He's always held on to the ball a little bit longer than quarterbacks, sort of sacrificed interceptions with sacks, that kind of thing, right? And he just sort of lent into that a little bit more piece by piece over time to the point where now, 5 years, 6 years later, it's like, okay, this is kind of a problem now because we know he's capable of so much more. But it took a long time to get there. And that sort of step-by-step approach was taking him down from a starting point of, like, this is the greatest play we've ever seen at the position. So that gradual decline passes from the greatest peak we've ever seen through, great play that other quarterbacks have as like their high point down to where he is now, which is like still pretty good. It's just that it's now becoming a frustrating issue because we know where he came from. But yeah, I think we're just in danger, of overrating his decline and B, forgetting how good his peak was.
Yeah, we hate highlight reels here in general, right? Obviously, his highlight reel still is outstanding. But at his peak, Sam, the highlight reel stuff, touch, zip, 60 yards, 60-yard dimes, all that stuff was all there. But there was a point where he was working pre-snap like Manning, Brady, Breeze. He's drawing teams off sides. He's taking stuff within the scheme. He's hitting easy throws that are there. I mean, that sounds easy, right? But that's quarterbacking, right? Quarterbacking is being really good 600 times, not 50 times, right? So that's why highlight reels don't matter, because you drop back 600 times in a season, right? You want to be good for all of those. At his peaks, he was doing all of that stuff in the pocket, outside the pocket, pre-snap, accuracy, all of it was great. Where he has deteriorated, to your point, is not playing within structure. Accuracy's waned a little bit, and then the highlight reel stays there. And that's why he's dropped from great to merely above average, probably in the last couple of years. But certainly deserving of number six on the list. Rob Gronkowski's number five. You're sitting there lamenting to me that maybe he should have been higher when we really look at Gronk, his impact, and simply just how good he has been at his position, historically.
Right. It's funny. Like you and me, we did this list, right? We're working through it. We start off with the grades. We make adjustments. We come back to it. We spend time debating various bits and pieces. And then kind of when you see it leak out, play by play or player by player on social media, the Twitter account PFF is putting it out. Like every now and again, one comes up. It's like, we probably probably made a mess of that. Like, that guy could have been, you know, a few spots higher, a few spots lower. Gronk comes out and it's like, he's five. I don't know that I can see an argument for him being lower than three once I, you know, think about it again. And it's like, I don't know that there's been any player at any position that's had a sustained level of dominance like Gronk, right? Basically, the only thing you can nitpick is injuries, right? Injuries cost him. Injuries cost him, I think, honestly, being the number one player on this list. Like, he came in and completely redefined what you thought the position was. Like, we were transitioning to this period in the NFL of matchup problems being Jimmy Graham-type receivers, right? Guys that didn't block but were too big for defensive backs to cover and too fast and too athletic for linebackers to cover. But Gronk was A, every bit the match of Jimmy Graham from a receiving point of view, and B, could block as well as the best blocking specialist tight ends in the NFL. Like, there are guys who had roster spots for years just to play, right, just to play like an extra tackle, just to be an extra blocking tight end who in theory can catch a pass. Gronk was as good as those guys, but was also the best receiving tight end in the NFL. Like, George Kittle,
Kyle Brady meets Tony Gonzalez, all in one.
And George Kittle kind of screws up the symmetry, right? Because he ends up last year with the greatest single season in terms of PFF grade we've seen from a tight end. But the next six or seven seasons are all Gronk. It's like, it's Kittle number one, and then Gronk, like every year of his career. Or every healthy year.
And I would still, say Gronk is better than Kittle because he dictated scheme, while Kittle is good, but he does get schemed up well.
And whether he is or he isn't.
Gronk lined up outside in the back. He lined up everywhere.
And whether he is or he isn't,
they fed him.
It's one season versus, you know, six or seven in terms of Gronk. So I don't know there's been another player that has had this, that sustained level of just being so much better than everybody else in your position.
So Gronk's at number five. Sam is sad. He wanted to move him up even higher. But again, we're still in Hall of Fame territory. Gronk might be the best. That's the other thing, too. We're talking about Brady at one is maybe the best all time at his position. Gronk might be the best all time at his position. Richard Sherman's at number four. He's probably not the best cornerback of all time. But when you look at this entire decade, another guy, he was 2011 or 10. Why do I always confuse that?
Sherman, 11.
He was 11 as well. Another one of that incredible class that makes up, what, four out of this top 10 here, or top 11. And, you know, Sherman, he's played his role perfectly. He went to a team who used his skill set perfectly. He's with another team that's using his skill set perfectly. And he is the prototype of the quote unquote cover three corner.
Yeah. And again, I think that's the kind of thing that gets thrown around at him as a pejorative. You know, he was only a cover three corner, but Seattle's
not a negative. That is, if you're the prototype and you play it that well, like, that's a positive in my mind.
Well, whether you think it's a positive or a negative, it's not even necessarily accurate given what Seattle were playing. Like, this was always a team that played a lot of man coverage as well as the cover three stuff that they used. They just did it in a different way. Like, they never used Sherman to track receivers, but they would lock him up on an island on the backside of a formation and then roll everything else away from him. So they, I think, took advantage of his skills as much as the Jets did with Revis or the Cardinals with Peterson. And when you just look at his numbers over the decade, they pretty much speak for themselves, right? Two cornerbacks in the decade allowed a completion rate under 50%, Revis and Sherman. And Sherman did it for, you know, almost double the amount of time that Revis did. Sherman also allowed the lowest yards per coverage snap. So effectively, how much yardage you're giving up for every snap you're actually covering somebody. Lowest in the NFL, under a yard per coverage snap, and the lowest passer rating when targeted. So basically, every single statistical category you can look at, Sherman was the number one guy among cornerbacks for the decade that played any kind of decent sample size. He was effectively the hardest cornerback in the NFL to complete passes on. That's basically what he's been throughout his entire career. The only thing that sort of holds him back from, you know, all-time great pantheons is that he didn't have a job as hard as a guy like Revis.
Yeah, and or as successful. I mean, nobody's ever had the 2009 Revis season, I don't think. Man, I wish we had some Dion. Deion wasn't targeted at the level Revis was in 09. All right, number three, we had Drew Brees, a guy just modeling consistency, you know, playing high level football. I think it's interesting that Breeze has had points where, you know, he had that one year he missed a game because of a shoulder injury. It looked like, hey, maybe this is it. You know, just like a lot of the greats, you know, it looks like this is it. He's going to fall off the cliff. And then he hasn't really happened. It hasn't really happened. Now he's up into his 40s, still playing at a high level. He does taper off at the end of seasons the last couple of years. We've seen that a little bit in the playoffs, but incredibly accurate, can still get the ball to all levels of the field, and just a great match with Sean Payton over there.
He's another guy I think that people are mad at for being both too high and too low. You know, we're being mad in both directions. It's like since he passed Peyton Manning in almost all the big accumulator statistical categories, it was like people suddenly woke up and decided he was the greatest quarterback of all time. It's like, he's number one now, so he's the best. And then but then the other way of looking at it as well, he was really good before that. Like nothing really changed. He just passed people in this statistical category. So I think Breeze, you're right. Accuracy is his calling card. He has been the most accurate quarterback in the NFL over the past decade. Highest, you know, adjusted completion percentages, highest exact ball location charting stuff. Breeze's accuracy has been incredible. And I think we kind of forget, this is not a unique thing to Breeze, but it's definitely something that works in his favor. He has not had the best receiving group for most of his time there. Like we think they're great now because they got Michael Thomas and he's one of the best receivers in the NFL. But like the majority of his career, there was maybe one guy and then a bunch of sort of role players that he transformed into players that could do really good things in that offense. But it's not like he's been working with, you know, a Hall of Famer for the majority of his time there. Like Manning has had better receivers. Rodgers has had better receivers. You know, Brady, you could argue, but he's at least had Gronk for basically the entire decade. I don't know that there's been a quarterback that ranks this high that's had, I don't want to say worse receivers, because it's not like they sucked, but that has had less help from a plus receiver group.
He has, and that offsets a little bit. I mean, the fact that, you know, Brady's always had McDaniels inconsistency. Breeze has had Peyton since 2006. So those also work in their favor a little bit as far as that consistency in the scheme and system. The Saints have always done a great job of saying, hey, here's the deep threat. What's the herd talking about here, Sam?
They're going to groom me about the 101. Don't worry about it.
What were they complaining about?
There's a few different things. We're going to have to talk about Matt Ryan versus Russell Wilson. Apparently, he thinks you have Gronk too high. So I'm good on
Gronk
that
too
one.
High.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And then we got guys like Patrick Willis too high because, you know, retired early.
Oh, okay. All right. That's good discussion. Anyway, Breeze has been fantastic. He's still going. We get to our number two guy. It's Aaron Donald. We mentioned, you know, his play against his peers is really unmatched. You know, it's stop sending messages to me, by the way. Stop.
Not.
We're live, and it's just clicking
people.
In my ear, and I'm sick of it.
Well, that's
right?
My fault.
This
that's
pivot
your lack
to Slack
of professionalism.
Thing. Well, I'm being distracted by this pivot to Slack. Tell Austin to stop talking.
Look, if you just get it together and be professional here. Be professional.
I just lost it. I'm sorry.
Work through it.
I'm sorry. That was bad. That was
bad. Really bad.
I absolutely lost it there. Poorly done. What are we talking about here? Aaron Donald, number two. Talk about how good. Talk about it. Talk about Aaron Donald and how dominant he's been.
I mean, you know, we said this for a while when J.J. Watt was at his peak. Donald is an anomalous data point off on the end of any chart you want to create, right? He pressures the quarterback at a different rate to anybody else in the NFL. He generates more pressure. He beats double teams. Everything, any way of quantifying pass rush, Donald is off on his own in a little nugget over here in an anomalous reading that you would expect to regress back to normal, only it never does. He's the fact that he's as productive and as prolific as he is from an interior alignment is ridiculous. It should not be possible. It hasn't been possible from anybody else. And he's able to do it consistently time after time after time. There's sort of been discussion about, can a player, like, so he should have won Defensive Player of the Year this past season as well. It's just that he won it so many times already that we're getting bored of giving it to him, right? But Donald is the best defensive player in the NFL. And unless his play drops off by a big distance, he will be the best defensive player in the NFL every single season until somebody else, all-time freaky, comes along. And no amount of Stephon Gilmore just having a really good year is going to knock him off that perch, no matter whether the vote goes to him or not. So Donald is playing at a level now that we've only really seen J.J. Watt attain in the past, and Watt, you know, got hurt and never really got back to that level. Donald is just is continuing to plug away at that point, and like the number of years he's doing it at this point is just beyond belief.
Yeah, Donald is awesome. Rushes the passer, plays the run. It's to the point where people, you know, there's a debate. What's better, interior pressure or edge pressure? And people say, hey, you'd rather have Aaron Donald. But like, again, getting that level of performance, it's like the 09 Revis season. It's not about the role. It's like, yes, if you could assure me that Aaron Donald's going to win 5% more than the next closest guy, I'll take it. You know, that's awesome. But yes, Aaron Donald has been in the league since 2014. And the fact that he's at 2 also explains his dominance, because Khalil Mack came in the same year and he didn't make the top 10. We mentioned Peyton earlier, only has like 4 seasons of actual good play this decade, and he's at 18. Aaron Donald's only been here since 2014, but we had to put him at number 2 because even missing those first few years, he's just been that good.
Right. Like, Donald is what, 34 pressures behind Ndamukong Suh, and he's been in the league, what, 4 fewer seasons?
Yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah. His pass rush win rate is over 20%. That is nuts. Like, Von Miller, we just talked about Von Miller being the best pass rusher of his generation. Von Miller is at 18.7. Donald is winning 2 percentage points higher than the greatest pass rusher of his generation, and he's doing it from an interior alignment where you're supposed to generate pressure less. Those guys are supposed to be less productive. I mean, I've been saying, no matter how good you think Aaron Donald is, you're underselling it. It's almost impossible to put into words just how absurd he is playing and has played at a consistent level so far. Like, he had his rookie year was good, not great, and then from that point on, he was the best player in the NFL.
That was similar to Watt, too. Both him and Watt came in with good seasons. It's like, hey, these guys look like really good rookies, and then the next year, before they were superstars immediately. All right, and then number one, we got Tom Brady. You talked about Peyton Manning kind of changing the way he played and all that stuff. Brady underwent a slightly different change. I thought in the middle of this decade, right when, you know, his play was tapering off and the weapons weren't great in 2013 and early 2014, I thought the two things he did was improve his deep ball, because everybody said, oh, he's good, you know, he's accurate, short and intermediate, but he improved the deep ball and he started making plays outside the pocket. And it was a handful of plays a year that I thought elevated him to maybe the best stretch of quarterback play, maybe in history, at least that we've seen, when you include throw for throw production from 2014 through 18, plus all the stuff that happened in the playoffs, the big moments in the playoffs, Super Bowl, crunch time, all that stuff. So Brady's the number one player this decade.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, nobody gets more of a postseason boost than Brady, who obviously was basically in every postseason for an extended period of time every single year, which is going to help. You had that hiccup of play where everyone is like, oh, Brady might be done. And then not only does he come back, but he comes back better than he's ever been before. Like, his stretch of play, like Manning's, the sort of second go around was better than the first go around. So you had his best play in this decade, a run of multiple seasons of just playing at this absurd level, and all the postseason boosts that no other quarterback gets. And that's why he's number one.
Just this, you know, those last 4 Super Bowls that he played in, remember, they won 3 out of 4 and, you know, they lost 138-33. But in the fourth quarter of those Super Bowls, 92 grade, completing 75% of his passes, 4 touchdowns, no interceptions, led a comeback against the Seahawks. He essentially led a fourth quarter comeback in all of them. But then they eventually lost it to the Philadelphia Eagles. So all of that stuff rolled in to this decade and the way Brady has played, and he's number one on the list. Yep. Highest graded overall player of the entire decade, Tom Brady. And he's now at another pivot point in his career. Is he going to have another 7 great years after this, Sam, now that everybody's writing him off after 2019? Can he rejuvenate in Tampa Bay?
I mean,
for the next decade,
have one, like, whatever about multiple, if he just tax on one more great year at the back end of this?
Brady and Manning were both the NFL's all decade quarterbacks for last decade. Brady, I think it was Brady and Breeze, or no, Brady and Rodgers for this decade. Will Brady be an all decade quarterback for the next decade, Sam?
No.
Okay, you're right. All right. Is that it? That'll do
it.
PFF All-Decade 101. It's the best 101 players of 2010 through 19. Go check it out. PFF.com. Sam wrote the 12,000 plus words. I did 5% of it. So appreciate all of the hard work that we put in to this list over at PFF.com. We'll be back again Monday with some more awesome podcasting, NFL off-season discussion. And we're getting closer and closer to our really cool off-season throwback stories that we'll be getting into. All right. All right, thanks to everybody for tuning in. We'll talk to you guys again on Monday. Quick break to tell you guys about NFL Game Pass, the only way that you can replay every game all season long. You can relive all the gutsy calls, crazy catches, wild comebacks, and breakout stars from every game every week. It's all the action, all the football you can handle, all in one place. So every game that we're talking about right now, you guys can rewatch it after the fact. I'm going to be going back, and you guys can too. Go check out Lamar Jackson in week one. Go check out Dak Prescott and what that Cowboys offense actually did. Go check out Kyler Murray and his NFL debut. That's my favorite thing about NFL Game Pass. You can go back and watch at any time. And if you haven't watched a condensed game yet, you have to try it out. It's every play from the game back to back to back, so you can replay an entire NFL game in the fraction of the time it normally takes. It's how I'm able to follow all the MVP candidates, all the breakout stars, and, of course, your waiver wire pickups all season long. To see all the action this season and stay on top of all the big storylines, you need NFL Game Pass. Best of all, you can kick off the 2019 NFL season with a 7-day free trial of NFL Game Pass. Just sign up now at NFL.com/ProFootballFocusNFL.